Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. 20 years ago this month, President Clinton signed the Family and Medical Leave Act. It was designed to provide unpaid leave for an employee who has a baby or is dealing with a serious illness in the family. And while some folks have certainly taken advantage of the rights provided by that legislation, workers' rights groups argue 2 decades later, many employees still face difficult choices between family and work. How about you? Do you take all the vacation time you've earned at work, or do you feel pressure from your employer or maybe from your coworkers not to take too much time off? Today on the program, we will talk about the challenges associated with developing a good work-life balance with two guests. Deborah Stone is Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Deb Stone, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us.
Thanks.
And John DeGraff is a documentary filmmaker, an activist, and executive director of an organization called Take Back Your Time, which challenges the idea that your job should be squarely at the top of your priority list. John DeGraff, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be on the show.
Glad to have you with us as well. And as we begin our discussion, we welcome your thoughts about the unspoken politics of taking time off from work and what steps you take to ensure a good work-life balance. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus 580. John, do we overemphasize work today?
Well, in my opinion, we do as a country. We are in some ways pretty much the workaholics of the rich world, although the Japanese and the South Koreans give us a little bit of competition in that department. But in comparison, for example, to Western Europe or many other parts of the world, Americans tend to work much longer hours. And in particular, we enjoy far less holiday and vacation time than our peers in the rest of the world. And we don't get certain rights that are simply absolutely taken for granted virtually everywhere in the world. One of those is the whole thing of paid family leave, and we're talking about the Family and Medical Leave Act, which is, again, 20 years old. It only covers about 50% of American workers, because if you work for a firm with fewer than 50 employers, you're not employees, you're not covered by that. And it does not carry pay. It's an unpaid leave. We are the one of only 4 nations in the entire world that don't guarantee at least some paid time off for moms when they have a baby. The other 3 are Swaziland, Liberia, and Papua New Guinea. So we're in pretty small company when you concern the whole world when it comes to at least paid family leave. And that costs us in many ways, I would argue.
Deb, it looked like you were thinking that maybe there are some exceptions to what John was saying.
Family medical leave can be paid. John's right. There's no requirement for it to be paid. But organizations or employees who have paid time available to them can use that during family medical leave. But that's probably one area where a lot of people do think that family medical leave equates to 12 weeks of pay, and it can, but it also can be 12 weeks of unpaid, as John said.
Let me ask both of you why it is you think Americans have sort of developed this culture over time where we put maybe a little more emphasis on work than maybe some other nations do. John?
Well, I think we have a great belief in the notion more generally that having stuff and consumerism and the good life kind of consists of an ever-growing economic pie in which we all have more than past generations in a material sense. And we have put a lot of our focus on the culture of consumerism, and that requires a lot of work to keep up. Additionally, we haven't seen for most Americans any real material gains from productivity since about 1980. Most Americans have seen their wages generally flatline, particularly median workers, even though productivity in the country has almost doubled during that span. It used to be that workers' salaries rose with productivity, but roughly evenly with the rise of productivity. From World War II on until about 1980, that was the case. And now we've seen a flattening. And so people, in order to kind of keep up with the expectations and yet not having any more money in real terms, tend to work longer and they tend to get deeper in debt to do that.
Deb, are we working harder just to keep up?
I think that's true. I think part of your question was, why do we do this? I think part of it is somewhat we have come along this idea of, if you come to this country back when it was first settled and work hard, and the amount of work you put into it or the amount of effort will have a direct relationship to how successful you are. And I think that we just continue to perpetuate that somewhat.
Are there unspoken politics when it comes to taking time off of work?
There can be. Certainly there can be. At an organization will very typically have policies about taking time off. So they'll say how many vacation days you get, how much paid time you have. Policies are really only part of the picture. It's also the culture. So you can have policies, but if the culture is to not really look very favorable upon using that time, that's where you get into the unspoken politics. And that's where it really depends on what is the philosophy of the leadership of the organization, down to the leadership, the direct supervision leadership for every individual employee.
John, I imagine folks can feel a sense of pressure coming to bear about the time they take off, when they take it off, how they deal with whatever leave they're given in a job, not just from employers, but maybe from fellow employees as well.
Yeah, I think so, because fellow employees often claim that, there's more work for them to do when others are off. We've done a rather poor job of cross-training people to take up slack and of figuring out how to deal with absences in the workplace. The Europeans put a great deal more focus on that because they have so much more time off. I mean, every European is guaranteed a minimum of 4 weeks of paid vacation a year as soon as they start the job. So they have to plan for that. We don't tend to do that. Now, Expedia finds, for example, that Americans leave 3 or 4 work days, vacation days, a year on the table. They don't take it. And most of the reports that we get around that are for two reasons. Number one, they don't want to be seen as slackers, so that they're the first to be let go in the next round of layoffs because they're not putting in the face time and they're not seen as committed 110% to the job. And secondly, because there is no way to take up much of this slack, many of them come back to so much overload, so many extra emails and so forth, that they almost feel the vacation wasn't worth it.
Deb, you're nodding.
I think that's true. I think another thing that can play into it is sometimes, very often, organizations will have policies that say whatever vacation you have accrued and not used, when you leave the organization, that will be paid out to you. So sometimes I think people think of that vacation time as sort of a savings account. So I'll bank it, I'll bank the time, and then when I leave, I'll have a fairly nice nest egg to take with me that I didn't really have to think about or consciously save that money.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the challenges associated with developing a good work-life balance with Deborah Stone, Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and John DeGraff, a documentary filmmaker and activist and executive director of an organization called Take Back Your Time. We welcome you to the conversation this morning. How do you and those in your life seek to balance commitments to work and to home? Do you or a loved one feel any pressure at work to not take time off to which you're entitled? Or is the opposite true and you're encouraged to take the time off? What is the culture like in your workplace surrounding how and when you do your work and how and when you break away from work? Let us know. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus 580. And we welcome other questions and comments, of course. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455. 855-800-222-9455. John, what is Take Back Your Time?
We're an organization that started back in 2002. We have an annual day, which is not celebrated so much anymore. We were more focused on that in the early days of the organization, called Take Back Your Time Day. It was set at the time for October 24th, which fell 9 weeks before the end of the year and symbolized the fact that Americans on average were working about 9 weeks more in annual hour terms than Western Europeans at that time. We still work a lot more than Western Europeans. It's slightly less than 9 weeks now since the recession. But Take Back Your Time's purpose was to try to call Americans' awareness to time poverty, as we call it, and to overwork in America, and really what the costs are that we pay for that. It's not that we'd get nothing from it. I mean, we do have a lot of consumer stuff and so forth, but we, in our opinion, we pay a very high cost for this, with the poorest health in, for example, the rich world, great amounts of stress and other kinds of things, the damage to the environment and so forth.
Deb, 20 years after the Family and Medical Leave Act was signed, has it, in your view, by and large, been helpful for families?
I would say that, yes, it is helpful for families because for the main provision, it protects an employee's job for 12 weeks. So if there is a situation such as the birth or adoption of a child or a serious health condition, while all of the time may not be paid, an employee cannot be fired for having utilized that time off. So I think that's a very key provision that is useful. And what I see is that people are planning and making use of that provision. Particularly, we see it when there is a birth or adoption, and it's very key and much more common that the parents, mother or father, sometimes both, will really take advantage of those 12 weeks to really have that critical bonding time with the child. And I think that that is something that is very key and helps people, as they know once they go back to work, they might have some realistic expectations of poverty of time. And so having that dedicated block of time, I think people really appreciate that.
Do you think we look at such long-term leave differently today than we did 20 years ago?
Yes.
In what ways?
I think that it is becoming much more expected. And so it's more of a norm. So instead of saying, oh, can you believe that she's taking 12 weeks off to stay home? It's the expectation. And I think that's a good thing.
John, I wonder, though, if it also comes back to this notion of, depending on the culture of the workplace environment, with the sheer number of personnel down in various industries and workers expected to do more and be more efficient, whether that does lead to some strain if someone's gone for a few months at a time.
Well, I think that it probably does. And all of these issues need very broad solutions to solve them. For example, I believe that shorter work time and shared work would be one real way to deal with our rather serious unemployment problems in this country, as the Germans have done, as the Dutch have done, and others. But cutting work hours for people who are making minimum wage or very low amounts of money isn't really feasible for those people given the costs that they face and so forth. So it really has to be coupled with something like a living wage at the bottom to make that feasible for those folks. So there are many things. This is not a simple matter of a fiat thing, let's do one thing or that one thing is the solution. It's a complex of issues centered around the fact that we Americans really have elevated work and consumption to something like obsessions in this country. We measure our success as a nation by what we call the gross domestic product. The grosser it gets, the better off we feel that we are. And it's really just a dollar valuation of the circulation of stuff in the economy. It doesn't tell us how healthy we are, how happy we are, how good our communities and relationships and connections are. All of the things that are essential for well-being are really ignored in this thing called the gross national product or gross domestic product. In fact, Robert Kennedy once said that it measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile.
Well, and to that end, we have another way perhaps of measuring what is known as gross national happiness. What is that?
Yeah, that's an idea that actually came up. The king of Bhutan, a tiny country in the Himalayas, 40 years ago, was asked what he would do to increase his country's gross national product. And he said, well, frankly, he thought gross national happiness was more more important than gross national product. And since that time, Bhutan has spent about 40 years bringing some of the world's greatest scientists, psychologists, economists, sociologists, and so forth, to that tiny country to help them figure out actually how to measure happiness and to increase happiness rather than GDP. And they have spread that idea to other countries. The United Nations has now called on all countries of the world to begin using that model from Bhutan. And I just had the wonderful experience just last week of spending a week in Bhutan with scientists and scholars from around the world looking at how we can really spread this message that we really need to measure well-being and sustainable well-being that doesn't destroy the environment as our goal, rather than simply measuring GDP.
So what are some of the factors that go into a gross national happiness measurement?
Well, Bhutan looks at 9 domains, they call them, of well-being, and those include things like access to education, they include health levels, they include psychological well-being or mental health, they include democratic governance, participation in government, community vitality and social support, probably the most important thing for well-being. Time balance is one of the 9. Work-life balance, essential for well-being for people. They look at access to culture. They look at many of these kinds of factors. So it's a broad approach to well-being based on what the best of social science tells us is necessary to make people happy, healthy, and wise.
Well, and I hear work-life balance as being one of the factors in it, but I imagine it also impacts those other factors that you just listed.
Oh, absolutely, because if you are too far out of balance, if you're working too much or if you are focused too much on one aspect of your life in terms of putting all your time and energy into it, you don't take time to exercise, you don't take time to eat right, your health suffers. You don't take the time or have the time to build these social connections and community connections and volunteer in your community, all of which are essential for health. You often don't take the time to be a good environmental steward. You're less likely, for example, you're more likely to buy convenience items, highly processed items, eat fast food, use transportation that is very high energy intensity because it gets you there faster and you really feel like you have to get there fast. There are so many impacts of time imbalance on all of the other elements that make up a good life or a happy life in the Bhutanese definition of this that, if you don't pay attention to time balance, and that's why I was actually asked to be at the conference in Bhutan, was to talk about the impact of time balance on the other domains.
All right, so how does the U.S. stack up in gross national happiness compared to Bhutan or other nations?
Well, we're a happier country overall than Bhutan. Bhutan's a very poor country, but they're considering their income and everything. I mean, they do very well, and it's pretty impressive what they have been doing. They don't claim to be the happiest country, but they're trying to figure out how to be that, and they are improving very rapidly. According to Gallup, which surveys 150 countries around the world each year, the U.S. ranks 11th in life satisfaction. Overall, there's also a lot of standard deviation, as we call it in the United States. That is, some parts of the population are much happier than others. If you look at the happiest countries in the world, they include places like Denmark, the Netherlands, Sweden, Norway. They score higher in life satisfaction, and they have much smaller standard deviation. In other words, the happiness is spread throughout the population to a greater degree. But the U.S. doesn't do badly, however, in comparison to our gross domestic product and what we pay, I think we could do a lot better if we change some of our policies.
Deb, to your knowledge, are the workplace policies any different in the United States compared to some of the other nations that John was just talking about?
Certainly they are different than some of those nations because some of them are probably more progressive than we are, especially when it comes to this time away from work when a child is born, for example. The Family Medical Leave Act that we talked about earlier has made big strides in that, but there are certainly countries that allow for even more time off without impact to job. You know, we're getting there. As John said, one thing that is true is there are a lot of people in this country, depending upon their job and their income, who, even though the Family Medical Leave Act exists and it might apply to them, they simply can't afford to take advantage of that. And that's one of the things that I think is something we haven't really figured out how to address in this country very well.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking today with Deborah Stone, Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois. Also with us is John DeGraff, a documentary filmmaker and activist and executive director of an organization called Take Back Your Time. We are discussing the challenges associated with developing a good work-life balance 20 years after the passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus 580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We had a caller who could not stay on the line, but who wanted to ask how European systems can be so good when their economies are broken. John?
European economies, generally speaking, are far from broken, and there's a great myth going on in the United States today that somehow Europe is the European social contract system, which includes these kinds of leave and stuff, are on the verge of collapse. The European countries that are doing worst right now are those countries that really followed the U.S. pattern, Ireland, for example, Spain, in deregulating their banks and in allowing housing bubbles and all of these kind of things. The countries that have the strongest social contracts in Europe, these happy countries, Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands, actually their economies have done quite well. Their unemployment rates are lower than the United States. Their balance of payments are better. Their trade deficits really don't exist. They have positive trade balances. And they're actually being asked to pay the cost of the failures of the countries that tended to follow the deregulate, cut tax model of the United States. So we're really hearing a lot of myths these days about what's going on in Europe.
I want to turn our subject a little bit towards technology. It was supposed to change the conversation, particularly the advent of the Internet. I'm thinking back over the last 20 years to the time when the Family Medical Leave Act was passed. In 1993, very few of us had any sort of access to anything approaching the Internet just yet. It was starting to really develop then. And the idea was, Deb, that we'd be able to accomplish things faster, and maybe that would leave more time for other pursuits. That didn't really happen, though, did it?
Not so much. It actually has, I think, been what has caused this creep. And especially as technology continues to evolve, and we all have smartphones, and we have our email on our smartphones, and every time it pings, we feel like we have to look and check it in, see what's going on, be continually available. And so I think that has changed things. I think the other thing that I think about, and I really thought a lot about this topic after I was contacted to come here, I had a family member say, maybe they should talk to somebody who knows how to balance work and life.
And, you know, really?
But then said, but you're better than you used to be. But part of that is I started to think about how do I really effectively manage my on-clock time. So my day when I'm in the office, am I managing that time as efficiently as possible? Or what are the things that are stealing time during that day that then personally I feel that I have to spend amount of time checking my email, doing things in the evening because I've literally been in a meeting of some kind back to back all day long. So that's something that I think we all need to think about. How are we most effectively using our time, and are we letting technology drive us instead of being more purposeful about how we spend our time?
John, you did a special for PBS called Running Out of Time, which I imagine addressed some of this.
Yeah, and it is a funny twist that, of course, our technologies that were supposed to save us time have resulted in our feeling more time pressed than ever, because our expectations go up. I mean, people now expect that the report be delivered yesterday, you know, and because it can be done, because you can get something constantly and people are sort of always potentially in reach, the notion seems to be that they ought to be in reach, and that they, if they're not, there's really something wrong with them and they're not performing up to expectations. I remember a class I took at the University of Wisconsin in the late 1960s. I was a sociology student, so you kind of get an idea how old I am. And it was a social problems class, and we were told that one of the great social problems that would be facing America at the end of the 20th century, which we sociologists would have to help solve, was the problem of too much leisure time. That with all of this automation and cybernation, we'd be working 15 to 20 hours a week, we'd have 7 to 10 weeks of vacation a year, and we'd have so much leisure time on our hands that we wouldn't know what to do with it. And I remember feeling at the time, wow, that's a problem I can deal with. But in fact, we didn't get that at all, and we have quite the opposite problem, and we don't know how to limit these kinds of things. And I'm guilty of that myself. It's tough.
Let's gain a little bit of a perspective from another country. Amy is in France and has some thoughts for us. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you. I'm actually American, but I live in France, and I'm actually home with a sick child today. and it's not at all a problem for my employer. Well, not at all. It does cause some difficulties, but I'm not made to feel guilty in any way if I have to stay home with a sick child, or if I'm sick myself, which is not always the case every place that people work. But I must say that I am. I have full-time employment in an engineering school, and there are a lot of people who work at the same place that I do that don't have the same rights because they are adjunct instructors rather than full-time professors. So not everybody has the same rights, unfortunately.
All right. Thanks very much for the comments, Deborah. And this points out the notion that it depends on the given culture, the given organization in which people work.
Right. It does.
And the status that they have.
Yes. Right. And also the job, the specific job that they have. It does change. There are different employment contracts and provisions by different types of jobs. And so that is a factor.
Sick leave is a very interesting one. I mean, I think it is. It certainly is a guarantee in other countries that you get at least a minimum amount of paid sick days. Now, the United States is a real outlier in that regard, and so we have no law regarding that. And about 40% of American workers don't receive any paid sick days, and that can be a real problem because we're really telling people, well, stay home when you're sick, and if you've got the flu, don't spread it around. But we're telling some of our lowest paid workers and our restaurant industry workers, for example, but still, you don't come to work, you don't get paid, so they show up sick and get the rest of us sick. And it's something we need to think about as a country. The other one is vacation time, which even if it's prorated in countries like France and stuff based on how much you work, everybody gets it by law. The United States is one of only five nations in the entire world that has no law regarding paid vacation time. The other four are Suriname, Guyana, Nepal, and Burma. Again, we're really an outlier in the world when it comes to protecting people's time off.
Deborah, there's also a difference between full-time and part-time employees in most any organization in terms of the kind of leave that they have. The sort of prize for a lot of people is to get that full-time job that provides health benefits, money towards retirement, a certain degree of certainty, I guess, maybe the best word. As such, do we as a society sort of devalue part-time work?
I would say that the policies say we do. I think if you ask people, they will say, well, no, we don't devalue part-time work. Of course, if that is what works for you, But the reality between the policies, when we only offer those things to full-time employees, then that sends a message that there is a devaluation of part-time work. Some of the best policies give those things on a prorated basis. So a lot of organizations will let part-time employees buy into benefits, buy into retirement on a prorated basis. What becomes sort of the unintended disincentive is they're already making less money as a part-time employee and having to pay a slightly higher cost. Then they end up opting out because they simply economically can't afford to do so. So that's another disconnect that I don't think we've found a very good answer to.
I think Deborah's absolutely right about that. And policy, again, I would argue, has so much to do with this. For example, in the European Union today, you cannot pay a part-time worker a lower hourly wage than a full-time worker for doing the same work. I mean, you can pay them less money because they're working fewer hours, but you can't pay them a lower hourly wage. And you must prorate key benefits.
You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the challenges associated with developing a good work-life balance. Our guests, Deborah Stone, Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and John DeGraff, a documentary filmmaker and activist and executive director of an organization called Take Back Your Time. We welcome you to the conversation. How do you and those in your life seek to balance commitments to work and home? Do you or a loved one feel any pressure at work to not take time off to which you're entitled? Or is the opposite true and you're encouraged to take time off? Maybe sometimes pressed to take time off. What is the culture like in your workplace surrounding how and when you do your work and how and when you break away from work? Let us know what you think. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post comments or questions on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus 580. And we welcome other questions and comments, of course. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we are talking today with John DeGraff, a documentary filmmaker and activist and executive director of the organization Take Back Your Time. Also with us is Deborah Stone, director of academic human resources at the University of Illinois. We are discussing the challenges associated with developing a good work-life balance 20 years after passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act. We welcome your questions and comments this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter and find us on either at Focus 580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Deb, you just mentioned off air that all these factors aside, and certainly these the factors we've been discussing in the first half of the program, from pressure at work and various policies, all of those do come into play. Ultimately, this is a personal choice about how you manage your time.
Right. I think it really comes down to for those who are fortunate enough to have jobs where they can work or choose to work for companies that are large enough to have these policies, although a lot of times very small organizations may not have written policies, but they might in some ways be able to be more flexible than a large organization, really comes down to personal choice and knowing what it is that's important to you and what's the right balance between work and life for you individually. And that's going to change over time as your personal situation changes. And so I think the first step is really some introspection and deciding what it is that's really important to you and how much of a balance you need to be happy.
This is John. I think Deborah is right about that. My only caveat and caution is that one of the axioms of happiness research is that people often don't know what will make them happy, and they tend to make the wrong choices initially, and they almost always will make a choice of money over time initially. And a good case study of this just happened that I want to mention took place in a place called Amador County, California, where in 2009, the work week was cut by the county supervisors to 4 days, 9 hours, 9-hour days, 36-hour week, 90% of pay because of budget cuts. The workers were at first extremely angry about this. The union protested. There was all sorts of anger. And they were told that 2 years later they could choose whether they wanted to go back to a longer work week, 5-day week with more pay, or stay at the shorter week. And and if they went back, of course, there might be some layoffs if there were still budget cuts. 2 years later, in 2011, the workers voted overwhelmingly, 71% to 29%, to remain on the shorter work week at less pay. Because having that experience, even though initially it was forced on them, they realized how valuable having that time was, and they got used to losing 10% of the income, but they said, wow, it makes such a difference for us to have that extra day off.
Let's take another call. We have Maureen on the line from Monticello. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to mention a couple things. I worked once for a company called EDS, which has its own reputation, and what they did is they assumed that you were taking your vacation. They didn't keep track of it, and when you gave notice, you were walked to the door, and you did not get reimbursed for any of your accumulated time. So someone surreptitiously told me, make sure you take a vacation before you give your resignation. So there are companies that assume you're putting in lots and lots of hours and you're responsible for your time, and they're not. And there's also companies in town that give you your hours, or they give you a good pay, and they say if you're not working 70 hours a week, then you're not worthy. But meanwhile, you're not getting any extra time. So it's on the person to be responsible for their work-life balance, but they also are caught between a rock and a hard place if they're trying to keep a job. So that's just my comment.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
I think it's absolutely true that there is really far less choice than we believe in all of this. I mean, there's such pressure that if you want a job at all, you accept these standards. Now, in the Netherlands, for example, with the Hours Adjustment Act of 2000, a law that's now also in place in Germany and Belgium, people really have the option of choosing the number of hours that they will work. And it would take too long to go into how this works, but it's a hugely popular program. It has led the Dutch to have the highest level of part-time work in the world, but part-time work that people really want, and that it makes enough money to live and gives them a chance to do other things. We pay enormous costs in the United States for our culture of overwork and the stresses that come from work. If you live in the United States today, you are almost 50% more likely after age 50 to suffer from heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, arthritis, and cancer than you would be if you lived in Europe. And workplace stress plays a big factor in all of this.
Deb, what about the question of what you can learn about an organization based off of its leave policies?
So certainly you can learn what the organization says it believes about policies. So do they have sick leave policies? Do they give you paid sick leave? Do they have vacation policies? Are they generous? Are they perhaps what seems to be a minimum standard compared to peers? So that's part of it. The other thing would be, what is the culture? So the caller referenced that a particular company or organization had a reputation. Those things, people do talk. So people do talk about, well, we have policies, but that's not really. They don't really expect you to use those. So particularly when someone is in the job market or looking for a job, that's where I go back to, you need to decide what is important to you, because you need to know how much of a balance you want in your life, and to the extent possible, you need to assess that against the employers that you're considering. Now, I realize a lot of us have jobs. We're not really in situations where we can just decide we're going to go take a different job. There are lots of reasons why We need to maintain the employment that we have. The only thing that I would say about that is to not make assumptions about the work-life balance. So if you feel that it's not working, that you are spending too much time, communication, talking with your direct leadership is the best thing, and not assume that you know how they're going to respond, because it is often possible that we tend to put stress and expectations on ourselves that may or may not be what our leadership really expects.
I think Deborah is right in this, and I think in most cases the valuable thing to do is to talk with the employer. I can say, though, that we hear cases of people who bring that subject up and they lose their jobs. I mean, that's one thing, for instance, that you can't do. In Europe, you have what's called the right to request there, to say, you know, I would like to work a little bit less, or I want to shift my schedule a little bit without losing your job. It's just it doesn't mean it'll be guaranteed or that it's going to happen, but you can do it without losing your job. Here it is still possible, and it still happens in cases that employees are fired for simply complaining about or not complaining, but questioning their work-life balance.
I think that it certainly depends a lot on how the conversation is started. Certainly, I know that there are cases where an individual will go in and come from a very demanding perspective to say, I have to have this, or I'm not doing this. And usually those types of lead-ins to conversations often end up not where anybody wants them to be. So I think if you are going to have this conversation, I would recommend that you really practice the conversation with someone else, because you want to have the conversation in a way that allows for conversation and for an exchange of why it's important to you, what it is that you need, as well as trying to give your employer the opportunity to say, here's what our needs are and how can we get to a common meeting of those needs. How that conversation is started and approached sometimes can mean all the difference. I'm not going to say that what John said is not accurate, because certainly there are instances, I would argue probably in most places in the world, in which you're going to have someone who takes an adverse employment action that they shouldn't have taken. It is going to happen. One thing that in this country, usually, particularly if you're in an organization where there is a human resources department, there's usually someone that you can go to talk about that. It does happen. I'll have to admit that.
What is the conversation that's taking place within HR circles these days among people who work in human resources about their role in ensuring a better work-life balance among all employees?
So certainly there is lots of discussion about these leave policies. One thing that is considered in a number of organizations is having a bank. So instead of saying you get X number of days of vacation, Y number of days for sick leave, it's paid time off. And so this is the amount of time that you have in paid time off. You manage it and use it for whatever you need. And so it's an attempt by the employers to say, I don't want to manage and control your time so much. I want you to be more in control of that. So that's one of the trends that we're seeing. But it's not just in paid time off. It's also looking at flexible work arrangements. So how much flexibility can you have in whether you're in the office every day or whether you're working from home sometimes? Are your hours strict and rigid, or can there be some flex in them? Can there be a flex situation or a job sharing? where it is more part-time. So all of those things are being talked about in the HR circles.
John, how can you tell the difference between an organization that may talk a good game about work-life balance and wellness and time off and one that walks the walk?
Well, you know, I don't know that I have an immediate answer to that. I'm glad to hear what Deborah's saying, and I know that there are many great organizations out there that are doing the right thing and that do exactly what she said. I think in some ways it depends more on not so much the organization, but on the worker and in terms of the skill levels that workers have. Employers, in a sense, have to respond to highly skilled employees that they can't afford to lose. But the people that I fear for and feel for most are those folks who are kind of at the bottom of the totem pole, both in terms of the compensation that they get in a material sense and in the money they make, but also in all of these benefits and so forth, and who are in many ways considered throwaways by their employers. I think that they actually do need policy protections as well as enlightened employers.
John, I was handed an article from the New York Times from just a couple of days ago indicating that based off of a recent survey, some half of employees assume they will work during their vacations. So does that get back to the sort of personal onus that at a certain point you have to say, I have to be able to disconnect from the job and get away?
Well, I think you do. And also you have to have some guaranteed vacation in the first place. We've seen since the recession large number of companies actually cutting vacation as a benefit, paid vacation time. In the state of Idaho, that number has reached something like 30% of companies actually eliminating paid vacation as a benefit, as a cost-cutting measure. So I think we actually need some legal protection in this country. Again, the only rich country in the world that has no protection, with the exception of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, where you actually get 3 weeks off by law, but no state has this, and I think we need to maybe start at the state level to have some laws guaranteeing vacation time, and then people really need to be encouraged to take that, because people who don't regularly take vacation, if they're male, they've got about a 30% higher chance of a heart attack. If they're female, 50% higher chance of a heart attack. If they're female, don't regularly take vacations, according to a Marshfield Clinic study in Wisconsin, they suffer from 2 to 8 times more depression than women who regularly take their vacations. And there are also great studies, Sleeping with Your Smartphone by the Harvard scholar Leslie Perlow looks at this and says that workers who don't take the electronic leash with them on vacation actually perform far better in the workplace when they're back there.
Deb, what would you like to see change, laws, policies, or otherwise, if anything, when it comes to how we juggle our time in and out of the workplace?
I really think that I agree with John that there are certain populations of our workforce who work on an hourly basis. They're paid overtime. I think John might have used the term throwaway employees. I think that is an aspect of the workforce in America that really we need to look at. How can we improve their work compact or contract? Because they are the lowest paid. A lot of times they may not even be guaranteed a 40-hour work week. And so this is the population that's really struggling. And that's where I think we need to devote a lot of our attention. There's a lot of good information. There's an organization called Families and Work that did a number of research studies that really looked at different industries and different levels of employment and how those differences impact people's perception of work-life balance, time off, flexibility. And there's a lot of really good information there that was actually done for the White House couple of years ago.
All right. Well, we'll post those links on our website. And I'm afraid we're going to have to...
great stuff. I agree with Deborah. The Chevy's Work does great stuff.
We're going to have to leave it there, though. So let me say thank you to our guest. Deb Stone is Director of Academic Human Resources at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Deb, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And John DeGraff is a documentary filmmaker, an activist, and executive director of Take Back Your Time. John, thank you for being with us today.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, we will welcome your questions for Michael Collins, Ireland's ambassador to the United States. We'll talk with him about the work he does and the relationship between the U.S. and Ireland. Ambassador Collins will be on campus next Friday to give the State of the European Union address, which kicks off the 12th annual European Union Day. Then on Wednesday, we will talk about statistics and we'll specifically talk about how they are sometimes misused or misinterpreted. We'll talk with Charles Whelan, author of the new book, Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft's our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.